Welcome. You are about to join the story of Lioness. Listen as host and author Diane Pendola brings you the Lioness Tale. Now it's time to come together and awaken to the liberating spirit that lives at the center of each of our lives. Here's Diane Pendola.
Hello, I'm your host, Diane Pendola, and you are listening to the Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit. In a past show with Dr. Susan Lawrence, author of Creating a Healing Society, we were introduced to the ACE study. ACE, A-C-E, is an acronym for Adverse Childhood Experiences. And today we are privileged to welcome Dr. Vincent Felitti, who's an internist and who has worked collaboratively with Kaiser Permanente and the Centers for Disease Control on this really exciting and breakthrough study. So welcome, Dr. Felitti.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, well, we're really happy to have you. But before we begin our conversation, I would like to begin the show, as we always do, with a moment of centering. So, for myself and for Vincent and for all you listening, let's just take a moment just to come in to breath, come into presence, come into the now, really, which is where all true creativity, all insight, all inspiration really comes out of. And open our hearts and our minds to the spirit of our conversation today. Now, this show, The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit, is based on my book, which explores, through story and metaphor, experiences of imprisonment, both inner and outer. And last week, we spoke with Dr. Howard Kornfeld, who's a chronic pain and addiction specialist, about the imprisonment of chronic pain and addiction. And so thank you, Dr. Felitti, for joining us today, because I really feel the study that you've been working with shows the roots, really, of what we talked about last week, the roots of chronic pain, of medical illness and addiction, as rooted in our experiences from childhood, traumatic experiences from childhood. So could you introduce a little bit more about yourself and tell us a little bit more about this study, ACE?
Well, I'm an internist. I have been at Kaiser Permanente for the past 41 years. I started out as an infectious disease physician, doing that work for about 10 years. I had a chance to put together a Department of Preventive Medicine in 1975, I had the impression that what was really needed was comprehensive understanding of people before one started thinking seriously about prevention, if one were to go beyond, you know, important but rather simplistic approaches like immunizations and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
We did that, and in the course of doing that work, we realized that many of the problems that we were turning up simply did not fit into the general acute care medical system.
Mm-hmm. And I so think one of the things that that's interesting to me, a lot of your insight leading you to the ACE study came out of working in an obesity program.
Yes, mm-hmm. and that indeed was the first program that we put together. And we were using a rather unusual technology that allows one to take a person's weight down about 300 pounds a year non-surgically. The technique is called supplemented absolute fasting, we were doing that, and the results were extraordinary to see.
So you were doing it successfully at one level.
Oh, yeah. And we're ultimately forced to realize that something totally unexpected and improbable was happening, namely we had an enormously high dropout rate that was essentially limited to people who were successfully doing what they said they wanted to do.
People were successfully losing weight,
fleeing the program partway through. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it really drove us nuts. I mean, here we had this extraordinary ability, and people came in saying they wanted to do that, and then would do it partway and flee without any explanation. And it was in the course, really out of annoyance of exploring this, that first we ran into the issue of childhood sexual abuse, then pretty soon other forms of child abuse, and then histories of growing up in massively dysfunctional households.
Mm-hmm.
I presented this in 1990 at a national meeting in Atlanta, and I remember I was sitting next to someone from the CDC at dinner that evening, and he pointed out, look, you know, if what you're saying is true, it's enormously important for the country as well as the practice of medicine, but no one's going to believe your 286 cases no matter how well you've studied them. What we need is a large epidemiologically sound study involving thousands of people and from a general population, not some subset.
Uh-huh. And when was this? What
1990. So we started planning this out, and then by about 1994, we had decided what we wanted to do and how to do it, and we asked 26,000 consecutive adults coming through the Department for Comprehensive Medical Evaluation whether they would help us understand more about how experiences in childhood might affect adult health later in life.
Mm-hmm.
And 17,500 of them agreed to help us. This is a very middle-class population, average age 57, 80% white, including Hispanic, 10% black, 10% Asian. 74% of the people had been to college. And we pursued 10 categories of adverse childhood experience. Being physically abused as a child, I'm not talking about spanking, I'm talking about heavy-duty beating.
Mm-hmm.
Being recurrently humiliated as a child, being sexually molested as a child, sustaining severe emotional or physical neglect, growing up in a home where one of the members of that household was an alcoholic or a drug user, growing up in a home where mother was treated violently, growing up in a home where someone was mentally ill, suicidal, or in the state hospital, growing up in a home where one of the members of the household was imprisoned during your childhood or adolescence, and growing up without both biological parents
mm-hmm.
for any reason.
So each of these would be one factor.
Each of those was one factor.
Huh.
And we didn't count the number of incidents. In other words, if you grew up with two alcoholics, that was simply 1 point for the category. If you were molested multiple times by multiple people, that was simply 1 point for the category.
Mm-hmm.
And we learned some extraordinary things, that in the general middle-class population, 28% of the women and 16% of the men acknowledged a history of contact sexual abuse in childhood or adolescence. 11% grew up in a house where mother was treated violently. 6% grew up in a home where one of the members was imprisoned during their childhood or adolescence. I mean, this was really quite extraordinary.
Well, it is quite extraordinary when you think this is not the populations that we expect this from. I mean, we expect
exactly.
this in the homeless or the disadvantaged populations.
Sure.
But this is a very middle-class group of
yep.
people who has health insurance with Kaiser.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then further, when we looked at the number of categories to which an individual had been exposed in childhood or adolescence and compared that to various outcomes later in life, various kinds of disease, chronic depression, alcoholism, smoking, suicide attempts, etc., the links were extraordinarily strong,
mm-hmm.
and proportionate to the number of categories to which individuals had been exposed. The so-called ACE score, if you were exposed to only one category, then that was 1 point. If you were exposed to any three, it was three. Any five, it was five, etc. That was interesting in its own right, because only 33% of the entire group had an exposure to none
uh-huh.
of the 10 categories.
Mm.
And I believe it was 1 in 9 people had an exposure to either 4 or 5 of the 10 categories. I don't recall precisely which it was. But the point is that as the number of categories increased, the probability of various outcomes increased very, very strongly and proportionately. And the magnitude of those increases was really totally unexpected. My colleagues at the CDC, at the Centers for Disease Control, told me repeatedly that they were numbers the magnitude of which a professional epidemiologist would run into once in a career.
Wow.
For instance, someone exposed to 6 or more of those categories was between 31 and 50-fold increase in attempting suicide later in life, a 3,100 to 5,000% increase in the likelihood of attempting suicide.
Oh my gosh.
A person exposed to any 6 of those categories, a male exposed to any 6 of those categories, was 4,600% more likely to become an intravenous drug user at some point later in life than a male exposed to none of those categories, et
cetera. Yes, and didn't I hear from you that women exposed to 6 or more, that 100% of them in your study were IV drug users?
Yes. That's really
phenomenal.
Rather, yes.
Yes.
So you know, there was an inescapable force of logic to this, and what was equally interesting is that many patients, given half a chance to speak openly, recognized that themselves and spoke very clearly to the point. I mean, I vividly remember one man who had been imprisoned at age 20 for attempted murder, having been beaten repeatedly by his stepfather for most of his childhood. Ultimately got out, became a good citizen, you know, working and so forth, and speaking about the necessity of smoking 3 packs a day, because without that, the rage he felt became uncontrollable, and he was fearful of, you know, being dangerous to people around him.
So the nicotine was helping him manage this
Yes.
early childhood trauma that still, of course, lives within him.
And that
so
was
it's not just a matter of quit smoking, is it?
Oh, no. I mean, that was the beginning of a series of counterintuitive insights. The superficial belief is, you know, smoking is bad for you, don't do it because I say it's bad for you, et cetera. And here we have somebody speaking powerfully and lucidly about the benefits of smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us are not used to thinking about two opposing forces going on simultaneously, you know, that something could be good and also could be bad. In fact, in nature, opposing forces are really the norm.
Mm-hmm.
So that is, you know, and similarly, we saw that for many people, obesity was protective. It was a way of de-sexing oneself.
Mm-hmm.
It was a way of looking bigger than life, of being physically protective. You think of the expression throwing your weight around.
Mm-hmm.
It was a way of reducing expectations of other people.
Mm-hmm.
That was really a very important insight that some of our most common public health problems were indeed that. I mean, they were serious public health problems, but also, and perhaps more importantly, they were unconsciously attempted solutions to personal problems that often dated back to childhood and that were hence concealed by time and then further concealed by shame and by secrecy and by social taboo. I mean, nice people, you know, don't ask about certain areas of human experience.
So we just have a few seconds, actually, before we have to go to break. But I think this is very interesting, this whole idea of the short-term benefit that people are seeking through smoking, using, through eating, through weight gain.
Yes.
That actually does become a kind of prison for them when they look at the long-term consequences of that. So it's almost like this feeling of catch-22, isn't it?
Well, there's an interesting book with the title Prisoners of Childhood that was written by a Swiss psychoanalyst named Alice Miller. Small book, very clearly written, and you know, marvelous book. Your listeners might be interested in reading about it on Amazon, Prisoners of Childhood by Alice Miller.
Great. So on that note, Prisoners of Childhood by Alice Miller, we'll go to break and we'll pick up the theme when we come back.
Okay.
Thank you.
Why have we come to earth? Do you remember? Why have we taken birth? Why have we come?
Hello, welcome back to The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit. I'm Diane Pendola, and we're speaking today with Dr. Vincent Felitti, who is one of the shakers and movers behind a very important study, the ACE study, Adult Adverse Childhood Experience Study. And we were just talking about a book by Alice Miller, Prisoners of Childhood, and I wanted to bring this back to my book, The Lioness Tale, because as people who've been following the show know that the main character of the book, the lioness, is deeply traumatized and wounded early on in her life and actually is largely amnesic to that experience. It's actually waking up to her wounding as part of a very instrumental part of her healing. And I was curious to hear in your working with the people, the obesity program, that many of the people involved had amnesia about a good part of their childhood.
Yeah, that was an interesting story, and again, that was something I stumbled into by accident. About 1985, and we're trying to figure out why people are fleeing their own success, I was talking in some detail with the woman, you know, what did you weigh when you were born? What did you weigh in kindergarten? What did you weigh in sixth grade when you first began to menstruate, when you graduated high school, et cetera, et cetera? We get to age 23, and she tells me that when she was 23, she was raped, and in the year subsequent, gained 105 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Whereupon she looked down at the carpet and muttered out loud to herself, overweight is overlooked, and that's the way I need to be. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, my God, woman, why are you in this program? A few weeks later, when she had lost 35 pounds, enough to be noticeable, she abruptly disappears from the program, is gone for 2.5 years, comes back. You don't need me to tell you she's regained the weight.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing is she had no recollection of the conversation.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and that, you know, and here I am, 24 years later, I remember the pattern of the carpet that she looked down at when she muttered that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had previously, you know, never thought seriously about amnesia, thinking it a theatrical device of movies of the early 40s. And suddenly I was face to face with, you know, with the reality of it. And so I decided to look at what the prevalence was in our weight program, and much to my surprise, in a 300-person sample, there was a 12% prevalence of amnesia. And you know, usually it was the sort of thing, you know, I just don't remember anything from when I was 10 to when I was 13, doctor. When I was 13, I was fat, and, you know, I don't, the 3 years before that are just kind of lost to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a real interesting insight, because ultimately people don't become amnesic for winning the lottery.
No.
Amnesia is
those good things.
Yeah, it's an unconscious protective device.
Yeah.
To escape overwhelming threat.
Because I do know a lot of people, you know, where you ask, what was your childhood like? There are people who can just remember everything from their childhood.
Sure.
And then there's people who have very little memory.
Yes.
At
yes.
all of their childhood experiences.
Yes, and that's a telling thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's really really amazing. Another thing that I'm very, very interested in is the ACE study and how it connects with addictions. We talked with about smoking.
This man that was in prison for attempted murder at age 20 in Rhode Island, he was in the penitentiary, spoke to that very eloquently. And again, you know, he was the one who started me thinking in a new track. And then, as I pursued this, I realized that there is extensive literature in the world's medical literature about the psychoactive benefits of nicotine.
Mm-hmm.
That it has potent anti-anxiety properties, that it has potent antidepressant activity, that it has potent anger suppressant activity, that it's a well-recognized appetite suppressant, although usually we don't think of it in fancy terminology like that, and that it actually improves intellectual performance. People do better after nicotine on standardized testing than they do without it.
Mm. So and the Native Americans had an insight.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely. They called it the peace pipe.
The peace pipe, absolutely. Fine example, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, they were not burning leaves in it. They were burning tobacco. That's a very, very important idea.
Mm-hmm.
So this then, you know, made us realize that the psychoactive benefits of nicotine occur in 20 seconds after inhalation. The risks of nicotine, which are certainly very real, occur 20 years in the future.
Uh-huh.
And most of us, when the pressure is on heavy enough, we'll end up selling out the future to gain current benefit.
Certainly.
And so that was an important idea as well, the concept that hidden in these various, quote, addictions were benefits that were not recognized for any number of purposes, largely because recognizing them was really too uncomfortable to recognize.
So this is very interesting to me too, because it's a whole new way of looking at addiction, that addictions are not so much substance dependent as they are experience dependent. In other words,
absolutely.
I can experiment with nicotine as a teenager and maybe smoke for a year out of peer pressure and quit and not have a problem. And then another person just tries and tries and tries and can't quit. Now, what's the difference? It's the same substance, isn't that right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So there's something other than the substance that's creating the addictive pattern.
And what we saw when we looked into it carefully in an organized way in 17,500 people is that the predictor of that was adverse childhood experiences, typically occurring many decades back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was true whether it was for intractable smoking, whether it was for alcoholism, whether it was for intravenous drug use, whether it was for the use of food. Mm-hmm. I mean, with food, you have two beneficial consequences. One is it helps people feel better. That's built into the language. You know, sit down, have something to eat, you'll feel better.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is the benefit of obesity. You know, lay aside the risk for obesity. That's real. I'm talking about the benefits of obesity.
Mm-hmm.
People expect less of you. It's a way of de-sexing oneself. It's a way of being physically protected, as in the expression, throwing your weight around.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And another telling example that I read in one of your article about addiction is about Vietnam vets coming back from Vietnam, and so many Vietnam vets used heroin over there.
Absolutely.
To be able to manage the pain of that situation. But in coming back, only 5% of them continued
their
heroin use.
That was really interesting. A researcher named Louise Robbins did a study, I believe it was on 985 Vietnam vets who, by their own acknowledgement, had used heroin daily for at least the prior 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
By anyone's criterion, that's got to be an addict, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to her and everyone's great surprise, she found that with no treatment whatsoever, 95% of these people, upon return to the United States within 6 months, were off heroin. It shakes your confidence in the addicting properties of heroin.
Absolutely. And it does point out the fact that there's something here that we have not been considering in the equation that is contributing to the addiction, that's not just the substance, which we, I think, are really kind of fixated on as a society, huh? That
yes.
If we can just get rid of the substance, if we can get rid of the heroin off the streets, if we can
uh-huh.
get rid of the prescription drugs out of the medicine cabinets, if we, then everything will be okay.
Yep.
And this is not what this study is showing us.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I thought was very interesting in looking at the ACE factors is that you have physical illness, huh? Physical consequences showing up 20, 30 years later, and you think, okay, that makes sense. These people are more prone to addictions, they're more prone to alcoholism, they're more prone to smoking, so of course you're going to see higher incidences of heart disease or pulmonary lung disease. But I think your study shows that even people who didn't move towards addictive substances are still getting those things in later life.
Yeah, that was a fascinating and important observation. Basically, there are two broad mechanisms by which one can get to many of the common chronic diseases. One, what you mentioned, through various coping devices like smoking, overeating, drinking, drug use, promiscuity, etc. I mean, those are perfectly valid ways of getting chronic hepatitis and diabetes and consequential heart disease, emphysema, etc. That's pretty easy to understand. Far more subtle is the other pathway to get to the same endpoint diseases, namely the results of chronic stress without involvement of any of the intermediating risk factors like smoking, overeating, drugging, etc. Chronic stress produces high levels of circulating cortisone.
Mm-hmm.
Many of your listeners will have some sense that taking high levels of cortisone medications for certain serious diseases has its own problems. I mean, it is, you know, not a minor therapeutic
decision.
High
anxiety, isn't it?
No. One of them would be osteoporosis. I mean, it's hardly the only way to get osteoporotic, but it's well known that if you're taking prednisone, let us say, for rheumatoid arthritis, that one of the consequences will be osteoporosis, etc. What we're beginning to see is that high levels of circulating cortisone as a result of chronic stress, not as a result of taking a medication, but as a result of chronic stress, cortisone being a stress hormone,
mm-hmm.
produce these same endpoints. And in situations of heavy-duty, unrelieved chronic stress, there tends to be collapse of that stress hormone system with the release of certain chemicals that produce inflammation in the lining of blood vessels. And those inflammatory changes are responsible for a number of diseases. It's now beginning to be thought that it's a major factor underlying the cause of coronary artery disease, heart attack. You know, certainly cholesterol is a big factor.
Mm-hmm.
Cholesterol is easy to measure, it's easy to see, etc. But it appears that a key factor is first inflammation in the lining of a blood vessel, and if you have high levels of circulating cholesterol, then the cholesterol gets attracted to the inflammation, causes clogging of the blood vessels. The disease primary pulmonary fibrosis, which I would have used as an example 10 or 20 years ago of an incontestably, you know, hardcore structural biomedical disease, now is recognized that at least some significant portion of that disease is in fact due to the release of these pro pro-inflammatory chemicals.
It sounds like in medicine where this is a paradigm shift in that we need
absolutely.
To begin to move from a narrow focus on symptoms to really bringing all of our psychosocial, medical insights and skills together into really treating the whole person.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, correct.
Well, that takes us to our next break, so when we come back, we'll pick up our conversation.
Okay.
Listening to The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit, with your host, Diane Pendola. If you would like to contact Diane, please send an email to thelionesstale@gmail.com. Again, that's thelionesstale@gmail.com. Now back to our program.
Hello, welcome back to The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit. We're talking today with Dr. Vincent Felitti. And we're talking about how this ACE study has incredible implications for our healthcare system and moving us away from just looking at symptoms to looking at the whole person. I'd like to quote, if I could, Doctor, from your article on addiction. And you say, this, of course, supports old psychoanalytic views and is at odds with current concepts, including those of biological psychiatry, drug treatment programs, and drug eradication programs. Our findings are disturbing to some because they imply that the basic causes of addiction lie within us and the way we treat each other, not in drug dealers or dangerous chemicals. They suggest that billions of dollars have been spent everywhere except where the answer is to be found. Would you like to comment further on that?
I'm pleased I was able to write that clearly a couple of years ago. where to begin? I certainly still think that's true.
Mm-hmm. And that the addiction lies within us and the way we treat each other. I guess I like to come back to that just because the way we treat each other, huh? Do we treat each other with compassion? Do we see each other's humanity? Do we recognize that we are all wounded, that we're all trying the best we can, really?
Yeah, I would say in general the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
that's infrequently done, and our ability to understand other people is seriously limited and superficial. Think how often when someone commits suicide, you know, it's totally unexpected. Oh, something must have snapped or some other, you know, profoundly insightful comment,
yes.
etc. Here we are in the ACE study being able to show, that adverse childhood experiences decades earlier are the profound determinants, not the only ones, but are the profound major determinants of suicide later in life. An interesting insight in Gulf War I, 1990, the prevalence of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and attempted suicide and so forth, subsequent to that, was unexpectedly high. Unexpectedly because there was only 170 hours of ground combat total in Gulf War I, and hence the basis for PTSD, simply wasn't there. The interesting thing was that was the first time we had an all-volunteer army.
Hmm.
And I remember when I heard that, I thought, what's happened is now we no longer have a cross section of the whole population. We're selecting people who are looking for a metaphor for a supportive family that they never had, and the Army is a wonderful metaphor for that.
What an interesting connection and insight into an all volunteer Army. Why that instance has skyrocketed in some ways?
Yes.
Yes.
yes. as have suicide rates, and this has not really been meaningfully looked at in general. In part because it's really quite threatening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting. In presenting the ACE study to large medical audiences, you know, 300, 400, 500 physicians in the audience, the speaker is typically the only person that can see the faces of the entire audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, by 8 or 10 minutes, the level of anguish on people's faces exceeds anything that you would possibly attribute to empathic responses. I mean, you recognize that probably personal ghosts are being awakened here.
Yes.
And then patients coming up to talk with me, you know, about that later, make the point inescapably clear. So that's one issue. I mean, nobody's standing in line in general to have personal ghosts awakened.
Right.
And even with a big enough audience, it's fairly common that there will be one or two people that will explosively leave the room with fits of uncontrolled bronchospastic coughing, as though asthma is being induced by hearing about this. So that's one point, and a very important one in terms of the resistance to using this information as opposed to, you know, thinking about it or talking.
Exactly, because that's the next question, and the implications for change in our medical establishment are huge, and there's resistance, but there's great resistance in our culture for looking at these issues, which we kind of bury in family systems, and the family is, you know, the family secrets and the taboos of speaking about such things. There's a lot of resistance to really letting this information into our consciousness, isn't there?
Yes, without question. Mm-hmm. And you remind me of another good book with the title Family Secrets. A man named John Bradshaw wrote the book some years ago, and it's a useful book for people. I found it an extremely interesting book, often recommended to patients.
Yes, I've done, actually working with women in prison, we had a program here where we'd get them out of, actually it was jail, county jail. We were able to get them out of county jail for weekends. Their sentencing judge would let them come up here to a beautiful natural environment. And we used John Bradshaw very much the first three steps of the 12-step program, kind of exploring something bigger than ourselves, basic goodness, and also looking then at childhood wounding and how that disconnects us from ourselves and our basic goodness.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yes, I recommend him, too, very much.
If any significant portion of your listeners are women in prison, they may be interested in a website, www.humaneexposures.com, humaneexposures.com. One of the three books depicted with photographs on that site is a book about women in jail. It's a stunningly good book, and it's essentially a photojournalistic depiction of the ACE study.
Yes, and I would recommend that to anyone. I've gone to the website. It's really, really quite striking. It looks very much like the jail that I've spent a lot of my time in. And I know that you're quoted very much in that photo journal. So humaneexposures.com, yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so what you're saying has huge ramifications, not just for our medical system, but also for something like our prison system. And
yes, for sure.
That is an area of my interest. What do you think are the implications for, so many of our institutions that don't recognize this kind of trauma motivating so much of our human action?
Rather than making a comment on that, I'd rather ask the question for people to ponder seriously. If someone were to give you a newborn infant and tell you you had 15 years to make a school shooter out of that infant, or 20 years to make a convict out of that infant, how would you do it? I mean, most people giggle and try to get the hell away from the question as soon as they can. Taking it seriously, how would you do that? Obviously, we know how to do that.
We know how to do it.
It's done on a very large scale.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually what we're continuing to do to traumatize people, say, in our prison system.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So we're not helping those people rehabilitate back into society the way we're treating them.
Oh, good God, no. Years ago, I spent a fair amount of time in the Texas State Penitentiary System in Huntsville, and it was a remarkable insight. There were a lot of men in that prison that really wanted to learn how to earn a living, and there was no serious attempt to doing that whatsoever. Yeah, you could get a job making license plates, but on the other hand, there was no license plate manufacturer once you got out.
Mm-hmm.
And the prison farm system in Arkansas, where I had a fair amount of experience, is the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was no way really to earn a serious living from anything that you were doing in there.
So we need to go to break, one last break, and when we come back, we'll wrap up our show. Hello, welcome back to The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit. My name is Diane Pendola, and we're talking today to Dr. Vincent Felitti. And Dr. Felitti, you mentioned in an article, as we talk about how do we bring these kind of changes into the society where when there's so much resistance, you feel that one way to do that is through story, movies, TV serials. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think so. The information is in one way or another generally threatening to people.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, a man named Eric Hoffer, H-O-F-F-E-R, wrote a wonderful small book called The Ordeal of Change about how even change for the better is threatening to people. And it was a really very useful book. And so I've slowly come to think a lot about, you know, how can we get these ideas across without doing so in the conventional manner, you know, of speaking straightforward, writing a book, writing an article. You know, people say, well, how about teaching it in schools? Well, yeah, that's fine until you have experience with local school boards and,
yes.
And realize the enormous resistance that's built in there. The idea came up of using narrative, of using storytelling for getting these ideas across, and you've, I think, done that superbly with your book, The Lioness Tale, which I'm really very impressed with. You're a skillful writer of really important and serious things, and presenting the story indirectly enough that it isn't overtly threatening, and yet at the same time the message gets through at some level.
Mm-hmm.
Soap operas have an enormous audience. I mean, you know, you're talking millions of people. The bill is paid for. The material is thematically lurid, etc. And the thought occurred to me that maybe this is the best approach. In this sense, if someone were to ask me what I thought the most important public health advance could be made in current times,
mm-hmm.
I would say to figure out how to improve parenting skills across the country.
There you go.
Because it really, that lies at the base of all of this, all of the coping devices, the smoking, the drinking, the drugging, and so forth, really have to do with trying to repair oneself. Typically from what happened in childhood.
Exactly. So having the resources for those first years of life to help
yes.
those young parents know how to cope, to know
yes.
to give them the skills to be good parents so that we aren't creating the next generation of people.
And you're mentioning the first years of life is a very important idea because it used to be that people would say, you know, to a good degree people still say this, oh, you know, the kid's not going to remember, he's only two, etc. Well, what's clear now from current advances in neurobiology is that someone may never consciously remember what happened at age two, but clearly what happened at age two affects the kind of brain that is being built at age two.
And I think that's what we're getting so many breakthroughs in that area, aren't we?
Neuroscience
and understanding the brain and how the brain is affected by these very early experiences in its development.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that have to do with building in the mechanism for chronic anxiety, for chronic depression, for chronic irritability, and so forth. And the way that got to be, no one's ever going to remember that. But it's perfectly clear from human studies and from animal studies that at a time when brain is being formed, damaging environmental experiences, you know, growing up in a house where people are continually fighting or threatening each other, et cetera, growing up in the sense of great insecurity, has very clear-cut effects on the kind of brain that is formed, and this plays out then decades later.
Mm-hmm.
So how can one get the message across for what good parenting looks like, for what destructive parenting looks like? The thought has recurrently occurred to me, soap opera is a marvelous vehicle. What if one were to build into the storyline of soap opera illustrations of what destructive parenting looked like, and more importantly, how it played out in the upcoming weeks and months of the soap opera, contrasting that with illustrations of what supportive parenting looked like and how it plays out in the subsequent weeks and months of the soap opera serial.
Excellent, because it is a way that we can begin to use television in a much more meaningful, creative, and socially healthful way.
Yes,
and it's currently being used.
And some beginnings have been made. I think, for instance, that this is kind of, you know, part of the appeal of shows like The Nanny and so forth.
Uh-huh.
I saw a show the other night titled The Dog Whisperer, about a guy named Cesar Millan, who is very effective at teaching, you know, rather vicious sometimes dogs to be more placid, etc. And it seemed to me that this guy had an enormous insight into what what would be good parenting skills for a child as well.
Yes.
So how to get this across soap operas? I mean, it seemed to me a vehicle of great use, because, you know, if you think about the role of theater, it's enormously important in this regard. If your husband's sleeping with a neighbor, if your kid's gay or on drugs, those are hard things to talk with people about.
Mm.
But if that's the storyline on soap opera, you know,
that's right.
Hey, did you see what's happening on the show this week? Oh, what do you think about
and
that?
And it does change people's attitudes about
those issues. Absolutely.
So we just have a few minutes left till we close, and just want to say something about my book. I kind of want to plug it a little bit, in the sense that I am going to be taking the book into particularly women's prison, and I just want to say that your work has really given me some fuel for believing in its power to really connect with people, and just this conversation about the power of
a
story.
It's a superbly well done book. I mean, that's something really to be proud of.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, something occurs to me. There's a newspaper called The Catholic Worker that has a big readership in prisons, as I understand it, because letters to the editor often come from prisons. And they have a book review column, and that might be a nice place to get that book reviewed, to get The Lioness Tale reviewed.
Great, thank you. And speaking of books, I think you have an upcoming book, don't you? Is that something you'd like to announce?
We
or is it there yet?
I wish I did. We are planning on having a book out about the ACE study, and it will be a general audience's book. And the title will probably be Turning Gold into Lead.
Uh-huh.
The subtitle will be The Adverse Childhood Experiences Study.
Uh-huh.
Because that really is what it's about, taking the potential gold of a newborn infant and destroying it.
Yes. Okay, well, just a minute left. So is there anything else, any other announcements, any websites that you'd like to send people to?
We have a website, www.acestudy.org, that people may find some interesting information on.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for being with us on our show today. I've just really appreciated it, and I feel very supported by your work. And thank you so much. You're going to be supporting hundreds of thousands of people, hopefully millions, by the insights that are being revealed to us through this study. So thank you for your commitment to it.
Well, I've enjoyed talking with you, and you should thank not only me, but my partner, Dr. Robert Panda at the CDC in Atlanta.
Very good,
because
thank
it was
you.
He who designed the study, and his group who analyzed literally several hundred thousand pages of patient information to get out in the literature what we have.
Very good. So thank you, Dr. Panda.
Yes.
So next week we will be moving back to the Enneagram. We'll be welcoming Father James Emperor, actually a Jesuit priest and spiritual director and theologian, to our show to talk about this whole area more from an orientation of spirituality and spiritual practice. So hope you will listen next week. So thanks again, Dr. Vincent Felitti, and thank you, everybody, for listening.
Author of The Lioness Tale, minister and Enneagram teacher Diane Pendola is the director and co-founder of Skyline Harvest, an eco-contemplative center in the Sierra foothills of Northern California. Living on 200 private acres with wooded trails and spectacular views, she offers Lioness Tale workshops, Enneagram consultations, and retreat opportunities. Diane created and conducts an in-prison transformational program called the Lioness Tale Prison Project. At Skyline Harvest, as well as inside prison walls, she advances the theme of her Voice America radio show, The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit. If you are interested in sponsoring this life-changing program for people inside prison, or if you wish to purchase Diane's book, schedule a consultation, retreat, or workshop at Skyline Harvest, contact Diane at www.ecocontemplative.org or call 530-288-0308. Again, that's ecocontemplative.org or call 530-288-0308.